Ah, home sweet home, Utrina declared, dropping her bags next to the wardrobe at the foot of Morgan 412's bunk bed and then sprawling, so much as one can sprawl on college beds, on the lower bunk. Be it ever so institutional. So what did you guys get for Christmas? Azalin asked. Utrina sat up, crossed her legs, and leaned forward to snag the strap of the smallish black plastic case that was among her items of baggage, while Kate did the same with the matching, slightly smaller case she had. The two girls shared a conspiratorial grin, then snapped the catches open together. Lesser Mazinger, Kate declared. Power on! Mazin, go! There was a soft, bright sound, and Lesser Mazinger rose up from his protective prison of formed foam to brandish his mighty fists on high. Wow! Said Azalin. Tiny Robo, Utrina announced to her wristwatch, which seemed to have turned into a small communications device. It's showtime!
Brrr,
said something inside her case, and then the lid was flung open by a mighty, tiny, blow, and Tiny Robo raised himself to action as well. The two small robots spotted each other and immediately leapt into action, rushing together in the middle of the floor and locking into a feigned clash. Azalin sat down on the floor to watch them, bubbling over with delight.
These are so cool! Did your brother make them, Kate?
Mm-hmm, Kate replied, looking a little smug. She watched the robots pretend to fight for a bit, then turned to her computer, humming a little tune. He made me a great birthday present, too, said Utrina. Poor guy. All those birthdays in that same week? He was just about worn out by New Year's. Want to see? Sure, said Azalin, beaming with anticipation. Utrina got hold of her duffel bag by the strap and dragged it onto the bed. Grinning, she unzipped it, rummaged around inside it, and then pulled out a long, narrow object which had been buried within the clothes and such. Azalin's eyes widened in surprise.
Whoa,
she declared. Utrina grinned, turning the sword over in her hands to slip her hand into the basket over its hilt and draw it from its scabbard.
Ooh,
said Azalin as the blade, its steel blued as deep as the basket, slid into view. Like it? Utrina asked. She rose to her feet, struck it on guard, and made a couple of easy cuts.
It's beautiful. Corwin made it? You mean by hand?
Mm-hmm, said Kate. I watched him do part of it. The basket took him a whole day.
I didn't know your brother was a swordsmith, Katie, said Azalin.
Oh, Corwin's a lot of things, said Kate offhandedly from her desk. She was deeply engrossed in what appeared to be a web search, the reflection of her display screen making her glasses look like data goggles.
What's it for? Azalin wondered.
Well, when I decided I needed one, I thought Sayanchi would probably be coming back around sometime, still cracked, Utrina replied. That's not a problem now, I guess, but even so. She shrugged. I feel better having it.
Gosh, you should. It's gorgeous.
Azalin got up and stepped closer, bending to examine the rose vine basket hilt with a critical eye.
Look at the detail! It has power, too, she added.
Utrina glanced at her, surprised that she could tell. Azalin looked up at her and smiled. Corwin must really think you're something special. Utrina's face went a bit pink as she replied, Yeah, I get the impression. Don't give him a hard time about it, huh? He's sort of sensitive. And his little sister's friend gave him nothing but grief about it all vacation. Azalin looked mildly offended. I would never give someone a hard time for friendship and warmth. It's a thing to be admired. Utrina chuckled. Right, I forgot. It's part of your religion. I'm sorry.
It's all right. Kate, what are you looking up?
Weapons laws and regulations, Kate replied.
Looks like you could wear the thorn in public, Utrina. If you were a member of a campus club whose activities had something to do with swords. Huh. Utrina sheathed the thorn of the rose and regarded it. Guess I'll have to join the fencing club or something, then. Good luck, said Kate glumly. Why? The fencing club belongs to Liza Broadbitch, said Azalin, scowling. Professor Harris is supposed to be the faculty advisor and all, but Liza's the captain, and Harris doesn't pay any attention. She runs it the way she wants. Oh. Utrina sat down on the edge of her bed and looked gloomy. That'll make it harder. Elizabeth Broadbank, eldest daughter of one of New Avalon's wealthier corporate families, was a fellow sophomore, the vice president of the student council, and at times appeared to be Caitlin's personal nemesis. She was unlikely to do Kate's roommate, who, unknown to Liza, had once impersonated her to the Boston police during an unauthorized adventure with the student council activities van, any favors. Especially since you're not really a fencer, said Kate. Liza's very big on form. Humph. I guess I might as well at least ask. The worst she can do is say no. Utrina put the sword down on her bed, got up, and collected her overcoat and hat from the back of her chair. Do you know where she lives? Founders Hall, said Azalin. One of the suites, but I don't know which one. 201, said Kate. It's in the council handbook. Thanks, said Utrina. Maybe I can catch her before lunch. See you there, she said, and opened the door to leave, nearly colliding as she did so with Corwin, who was just raising his hand to knock. Oops, she said, stopping and backing up to let him in. Everybody settled over at Galaxy House? Yep, said Corwin. I left them talking in the living room. Well, Moose and Miki were talking anyway. Dorothy doesn't have much to say yet. He grinned. But she wasn't hiding in her room anyway. Those two are going to need uniforms, said Kate, the thought just having struck her. They know, Corwin told her. Moose said he'd see to it after lunch. They'll come up here to eat with the rest of your gang. Aren't you staying for lunch? Asked Utrina. Nah, I wish I could, but I gotta get back. Corwin replied. I promised Hiroshi I'd be on Tomodachi tonight. I'm supposed to help him put together one of his Christmas presents, and I have to get Dagger Disc home for Dad before I can do that. He sighed. Man, this'll be so much easier when I have my own ship, or learn how to gate. Anyway, I can't stick around, much as I'd like to. Oh, that's too bad. Well, come on then, I'll walk you to your car. I was just on my way to ask an enemy of a friend for a favor. Corwin gave her a puzzled look at that, then went to take his leave of his sister. Goodbye, Corwin, said Kate as she hugged him. Thanks. For everything. Then she spoke the only phrase of Old Norse she knew, a parting she had learned from Skuld. Walk in glory, little brother. Live with courage, elder sister, he replied, squeezed her a little harder, and then let her go with a kiss on the cheek. See you soon, though. Said Kate, nodding with a bright smile. Corwin turned and said it was nice seeing Azalin again. She'd met him the previous year, when she'd visited New Avalon during the summer, received a pleasantry in return, and then he and Utrina went downstairs and exited the wedge on the quad side. They reached the back of his car and paused, a little awkwardly. Well, said Corwin. I guess I'll see you around. I'll be here, Utrina replied. Till summer, anyway, unless Kate decides to go home for CD break. Well, I'll be back to visit soon. I'll look forward to it, she said with a smile. The more awkward he became, the more at her ease she seemed to get in response. He smiled self-consciously and rubbed at the back of his neck with one hand, a gesture she'd noticed he indulged in often when he didn't quite know what to say. Now that she thought about it, it was a habit she shared at times. She wondered if maybe he'd picked it up from her. She'd have to ask Kate if he'd done it before. Thanks, he said. Well, so long, I guess, he went on, and stuck out his hand as if he were parting from his cousin Hiroshi. Hiroshi didn't usually use the hand as a lever to haul him into an embrace, though. For a second he was utterly at a loss before instinct kicked in and told him, "There's a girl hugging you. Get your arms around her and hug her back before you lose your window, fool." This he did, and as he held her and felt dizzy, Utrina repeated the syllables Kate had used, not understanding exactly what they meant, but trusting in context to make them appropriate. Corwin gave her the same reply. Then she let him go, whacked him cheerily on the shoulder, and said with a grin, "So long, Corwin. Don't be a stranger, huh?" Count on it, he said. Then she turned and went away from him with a spring in her step, pausing at the stone in the middle of the quad to turn back and wave. He waved back, then shook his head, got into his car, and fired it up. Then he sat there, watching the pink smudge of her hair until it disappeared around the back of Higgins Labs, before putting the Griffin in gear and backing out to leave. Above, Kate watched the car turn right and vanish around the end of Daniels in the other direction, and sighed. It was sweet and all, but this had the potential to get kind of complicated. Ah, well, these things work themselves out or they don't. "What's the matter, Katie?" asked Azalin from the floor, where she lay propped on her elbows reading Kate's new issue of Pianoforte magazine.
Nothing, Kate replied. "I hope."
Utrina returned to Morgan 412 20 minutes later, in a considerably poorer mood than she had left. "What an unbelievable bitch that girl is," were the first words out of her mouth as she entered, kicking the door shut behind her.
"I warned you," said Azalin.
"Do you know what she called me?" Utrina demanded, tossing her coat and hat onto her bed. "A girl I've never spoken to before in my life. I was nice, I was pleasant, I was polite."
"She called you a plebeian?" Azalin guessed.
"She called me a barbarian," Utrina replied.
"Ooh, that's new."
"Then she looked over my clothes and said..." And here, Utrina adopted a fairly decent rendition of Liza Broadbank's affected aristocratic drawl. "You know, darling, if you really wanted to be a man, I know a perfectly adequate clinic in Austria that shouldn't set your parents back more than 10 or 12 years' pay."
"Ouch," said Azalin. Then, with a hopeful look, the Dantrovian asked, "Did you kill her?"
"No, damn it," Utrina replied, throwing herself down in her armchair. "I wanted to, but then I thought I'd probably get expelled for it," she added, cracking the joke to keep from screaming or throwing something. "God, what a hateful person." She held up her hands, examining them, and went on, "Then she said she didn't think it would be worth giving me a tryout because with these indelicate hands, there'd be no way I'd be more than an adequate fencer, and the Worcester Preparatory Institute team is only for the very best, darling, you understand." She frowned. "I don't think I have indelicate hands." As it often did when she looked at her left hand, Utrina's gaze went briefly to the little white scar at the base of her left ring finger, and as it did, her expression changed from a glum frown to a thoughtful one, and from that to a look of dawning realization, and from that to a sly grin. "Kate," she said, lowering her right hand and continuing to survey her left. "If we can't get into the fencing club," said Utrina, "then why don't we start our own?" They unveiled it at table 11 over lunch, having spent 15 minutes sketching the concept out before dashing down to catch the tail end of the Deka lunch window. There were a lot of parents on campus today, dropping off their kids and grabbing a bite before leaving again, so the food was considerably more palatable than normal. Moose McEachern looked a bit skeptical.
"The Institute Duelists Society," he said.
"Yeah," Utrina replied. "Listen, the only weapons-based martial arts club on this campus right now is the fencing club, right?"
"Unless you count archery and shooting as martial arts," said Caitlin, "which I think you really should." Okay, fine, Utrina conceded. But it's the only one with melee weapons, right?
Uh-huh, said Moose.
And, Utrina went on, the fencing club is extremely strict about their definition of fencing. Even Kenduka and the like can't get in. European-style fencing only. And because Liza Broadbank is running it, you also have to be in her little clique.
For the most part, said Moose. True.
So, said Utrina, there's your need right there.
But Duelist Society, Devlin Carter protested. I don't think it'll fly if you present it to the deans like that, eh, what? This isn't the kind of school where they want the students going round scarring each other, cutting each other's ears off and whatnot.
No need for that. I know another way. At my old school, we had this system.
Loses the duel, she finished, and waited with a respectful expectancy.
There was a rather long silence. President Roland Tiefeld cleared his throat, shuffled some papers on the desk in front of him, and then regarded her over the tops of his small, oblong spectacles.
"These duels were fought with real weapons? Live steel?" he asked her.
"That's right, yes, sir," Utrina replied.
"Isn't that dangerous?" asked Clarice Garwood. As the Dean of Campus Safety and Security, she cut straight to the part of the equation that interested her most.
"It can be," Utrina admitted, "but it's the surest way of ensuring that the duelists give it their best, and if the selection is careful enough, no one will be unskilled enough to be in any real danger."
She ignored the little voice in her head reminding her that she had been unskilled enough to be in plenty of real danger back in the day.
"Hmm," said Professor Aaron Harris, faculty advisor and coach of the fencing club. "I don't see the need. We already have a perfectly fine venue for this in the fencing club, and we use safety equipment."
"With all due respect, Professor, dueling is not fencing," Utrina replied. "The whole point of the Duelist Society is to create a venue for weapons artists of all different styles and traditions to test themselves against one another, to face diverse opponents in a freestyle contest. Isn't diversity supposed to be one of the Institute's cornerstones, Mr. President?"
said the President. "She has a point, you know, Aaron. Your fencers are all of a type. That's the nature of the sport. What Miss Tenjo is talking about isn't so much a sport as a self-betterment exercise."
"A dangerous and foolhardy one, if you ask me," said Harris. "The administration of her old school must have been out of their mind to permit students to attack each other with live weapons and no safeguards."
"You should have seen the arena," thought Utrina.
"They didn't just permit it, they encouraged it," she told the panel. "At the academy, duelists were selected by the deputy chairman of the school's board of trustees."
"Who will screen your members here? No one on the faculty has the martial skill, experience, or spare time for such an endeavor," said Dean Garwood. Professor Harris looked a little miffed at having been left out of the martial skill category, but said nothing.
"We'll do it ourselves," said Utrina, "with the help of our administrative advisor." At Garwood's skeptical look, she plunged recklessly on. "I was the champion duelist of Otori Academy last year. That means I defeated every other duelist there more than once over the course of the school year without anyone ever getting seriously hurt. I think I'm qualified to judge who is and isn't duelist material."
"You do?" she blurted internally as the words came out of her mouth.
"How is it, if this school was so advanced, that none of us has ever heard of it?" said Professor Harris pointedly.
"It was a good school," said Utrina, and she steeled herself internally for the first, and hopefully last, bald-faced lie she would have to tell the assembled administrators. "But it was on the Outer Rim, and, well..." She did her best to look as troubled as possible as she went on. "The Raiders..." She shook her head and returned to the more comfortable realm of semi-truth. "I have no home to go back to now," she said, hanging her head. For such an utterly untalented liar, she did a pretty decent job with that one. President Tiefeld cleared his throat uncomfortably.
"There now, Miss Tenjo," he said. "I'm sure Professor Harris didn't mean to dredge up unpleasant memories.
Certainly we accept your word as a student and a gentlewoman as to your former situation. It's just that, well, this is all quite irregular, and we must be sure we aren't letting the Institute in for any problems.
Think of the insurance, said Professor Harris. The parental protests.
I'm not proposing we force people to be duelists, Utrina pointed out, pulling herself together from her memories of her fictitious homeworld on the Rim. Of course, we'll have to get releases from the parents involved and explain to them exactly what their kids will be doing, but...
I've heard enough, said Harris peremptorily. Mr. President, there's no need to continue this further. My mind is made up. My decision is no.
You aren't the only one who gets to decide, Aaron, said Tiefeld gently.
Professor Harris has... began Dean Garwood, but Utrina cut her off, rising to her feet and speaking hotly.
The code of the Worcester Preparatory Institute, she declared, slapping an open palm down on her copy of the WPI student handbook, states that the purpose of this institute is to promote the intellectual growth, physical strength, and emotional well-being of its students by challenging them to excel in every possible facet of sentient existence, to strive for greatness in all that they do, and to take control of their destinies to the fullest extent possible. Are those just words, or do they mean something to this board? She inquired, leaning forward with her hands on the table.
We realize that our request is an exceptional one, but we are exceptional individuals. This school is supposed to be here to train the leaders of tomorrow. Well, judging by current events, that tomorrow is likely to be a difficult and dangerous time. How can we be expected to shoulder that responsibility if we're protected from the danger of striving to be our best?
President Tiefeld gazed across the boardroom at the impassioned face of this unusual student, looked her square in the eyes, and smiled ever so slightly.
Miss Tenjo, he said, you raise an excellent point. Dean Garwood, Professor Harris, and I will need to discuss your proposal privately for a few minutes. If you could wait outside, we'll send for you when we've reached a decision.
Utrina straightened herself, squared and bowed stiffly, then collected her things.
Thank you, Mr. President, she said, then turned smartly and marched out.
The instant the doors closed behind her, she sagged back against them and slid down, her knees giving way, to sit on the floor and get a good start on hyperventilating.
Wow, Utrina, said Mickey from one of the straight-back chairs along the wall next to the doors.
"We could hear you clear out here," Azalin added. "What a speech! I don't think anybody's ever quoted the code at an administrative review panel before."
"Especially not one with cast-iron Garwood on it," said Moose.
Do you need a bag or something?" asked Kate, concerned.
No, I'm fine," said Utrina. She picked herself up and went to the empty chair next to Kate.
I'm fine. Harris just made me so mad. When I get mad, sometimes I do crazy things.
Sionji laughed. Utrina glanced sharply at him, then smiled. It was a little surreal, Sionji being here, Sionji being able to laugh at his own expense. 3 days had gone by. It was Monday afternoon, and she still hadn't quite gotten over what had passed between them Friday night.
It was 8:30, and Caitlin was at her piano, fooling around with a ragtime piece she'd thrown together for a lark on the flight back from Zeta Cygni. Utrina lounged in her armchair, still working on the Great Book of Amber, and missing the little warm weight of Nall, Corwin Ravenhair's flying cat companion who claimed to be a dragon, in her lap, where he'd spent the bulk of her reading time during her sojourn in New Avalon. Because of the piano, they almost didn't hear the knock at the door, but the second time it came, it was loud enough for them to notice and stop what they were doing to attend to it. Kate got up, covered the keys, switched off the acoustic dampers, and opened the door while Utrina craned around in her chair to see who was visiting.
"Oh," said Kate, it's you.
"You needn't sound so thrilled," said Kyuichi Sionji dryly. "May I come in? I'll only be a moment." Kate looked a bit ambivalent, but she let him in anyway, and went to stand by the piano, her left hand unobtrusively taking up her Zatoichi from where it had been leaning against the wall next to the instrument. Utena got up from her chair, darting a glance at the thorn of the rose, which hung by the sword belt from the corner post of Kate's top bunk. "I have a thing to say to you as well, Miss Hutchins," said Sionji formally, "but my business with Miss Tenjo is more overdue, if you don't mind." Caitlin nodded, wary but not hostile, and he nodded in return by way of thanks before turning to Utena. He regarded her calmly for a moment, then one corner of his mouth quirked, just barely, into the faintest hint of a smile, and he drew the tachi from his side. Utena jumped back a couple of feet, braced herself, and made ready to lunge for her own weapon, wondering if Kate would be willing to attack him from behind to stop him from reaching her. Inwardly, she cursed Azalin, "Feeling much better, my ass." Then Sionji did something that startled Utena almost as much as she had ever been surprised in her life. He dropped to one knee, bowed his head, and laid his sword at her feet. "Utena Tenjo," he said, his voice quiet and even, "I salute you." Utena stared down at him in utter astonishment. Behind him, Kate slowly returned the 12 or so inches of her Zatoichi she'd drawn back to the scabbard. "You what?" He looked up at her, brushed a bit of his long, disordered green hair out of his eyes, and repeated, "I salute you, Utena Tenjo. You have remained true to the ideals that you hold dear. You triumphed over the cynicism, the bitter megalomania of Akio Otori, and were not perverted by him." He lowered his eyes again and continued in a dark murmur, "Unlike me, I was weak. I failed to be true to myself. I let myself become cruel and stupid, and abused the people that I loved." He shook his head, and tears spattered his clenched fists. "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry." Utena blinked at him. "Sionji," she whispered, shocked. "My memory is still a bit disjointed," Sionji went on, "but I remember some important things. One is that I owe you an apology. Another is that I owe the Rose Bride a great deal more." He looked back up at her, that faint hint of a smile toying with his mouth again, and said, "I thought I'd start with the easier one first." Utena couldn't help it. At the wryness in his voice and the tiny trace of humor on his face, she had to crack a smile. Dropping down to a catcher's crouch to be at eye level with him, she said soberly, "I won't lie. There was a time when I'd have thrown your apology in your face and told you to choke on it. But here, now, today..." She gestured around to the room, and in a more metaphorical sense, her life as it now was, and nodded. "I can accept it." At the look of hope that stole onto his long face, she raised a cautionary finger and went on, "But only for me, mind you. Himemia, you'll have to come to your own terms with. I won't speak for her." Sionji nodded. "I understand. And in that regard, I..." He paused as if gathering courage, then plunged on, "I have a favor to ask of you." Utena gave him a look that managed to combine puzzlement, slight apprehension, and a cue to go on. "When you find Danthi, for I have no doubt you will you tell her that I'm sorry? That I curse myself for the weakness and stupidity that led me to mistreat her? Will you tell her..." He paused, shedding a couple more tears, and looked Utena full in the face with a look of raw regret. "Will you tell her that, however mad I was, however warped it was by that madness, the love I had for her was real? Whatever else you think of me, you must believe that." Utena didn't know what to say.
She looked back at him for several seconds, completely at a loss, before bowing her head and putting a hand on his shoulder.
"When I find her," she said finally, slowly, picking her words with care, "when I find her, you can tell her all that yourself, because if she'll come, I'm bringing her back here."
She raised that admonishing finger again, only half serious, and added briskly, "But don't let that give you any ideas." He half smiled, even half laughed, caught between remorse, surprise, disbelief, and pleasure. "I have none," he told her, still half smiling but entirely serious. "You are the winner of the tournament. You are the prince of the 10th world. The Rose Bride is yours." He chuckled wryly. "I understand now that she would be anyway, tournament or no tournament."
Utina sat back on her heels and regarded him, shaking her head in wonder. "Man, what did Azalin do to you?"
"It's not what she did," said Sionji. "It's what she undid. She made me remember that my purpose, the purpose of the whole tournament, was perverted, and only you saw the truth."
He raised his left hand to show her the duelist signet he wore, his original one, which he'd put back on before setting off on his misguided but well-intentioned trek to find the missing Rose Bride.
"As a Notori Academy duelist, it is my sworn duty to support you, Prince Tenjo."
"Stop that," she said. "I'm not the prince, Sionji. When it came right down to the end, I couldn't do it. That's why I'm here. In the end, I failed."
Sionji shook his head. "No, you may not have succeeded in the way you expected, but you succeeded all the same. Otori wouldn't be so scared if you'd failed completely."
"Scared?"
He told her about the last meeting. When he'd finished, she sat back a little farther still, then settled, cross-legged, to think it over.
"That miserable son of a bitch," she said, "and now he's got Toga and Nanami hunting her."
"Toga isn't hunting her, he's hunting you," said Sionji. "If he finds Anthe alone, and she convinces him she doesn't know where you are, my guess is he'll ignore her and keep looking for you. He might even help her in her search in hopes that she'll lead him to you. As for Nanami, do you really think she's clever enough to track an elephant, let alone Anthe?"
"She's smarter than you give her credit for," Utina told him. "But I think you're probably right. Himemia can handle her. Nanami's afraid of her. I'm not sure why, but she is."
"That will be useful," Sionji agreed. "At any rate, there's more to Anthe than Nanami or Toga realize. And now that she's outside the strictures of the tournament, she'll be free to use whatever means she has to stay that way." Sionji smiled a little. "I'd almost like to see Toga's face if he does find her. Even when he was engaged to her, he never had the slightest idea what she was really capable of." Utina shrugged, looking a little sheepish.
"Neither did I for most of the time."
"No, nor I," said Sionji. "But hindsight is a powerful tool, and Toga lacks it. He sees only his next goal, his next conquest."
"Yeah, I hear that."
Pause.
"You know," said Utina, "it's kind of creepy being on the same wavelength with you."
Sionji smiled a little more. Utina picked up his sword, got to her feet, and extended a hand to pull him up, then handed back the blade.
"Welcome back to the human race, Sionji."
"It's good to be back, Prince Tenjo," he replied as he put it away.
"Will you please not call me that?"
He smirked a little. "All right, Tenjo, I won't," he said, in a parody of his old chilly sneer. Utina smiled.
"That's better."
Sobering, he bowed to her again. "The hour grows late. I must conclude my business here and leave you to your reading. Thank you for listening to me."
Then he smiled a little smile once again. "Will you be stopping by for breakfast?"
"It seems likely," she said with a grin.
"Then I'll see you in the grill," said Sayanji. And he turned and crossed to Kate, who had stood by her piano in a polite silence throughout their little tete-a-tete in the middle of the room. "Miss Hutchins," he said, bowing, "I salute you as well. You are a woman of great courage, tenacity, loyalty, and skill. You are in all ways admirable. You humbled me when I sorely needed humbling. I am in your debt, and I apologize for being such an unmitigated ass at our first meeting."
I understand you weren't well,
said Kate. "That is true, but no excuse," Sayanji insisted. "Please, accept my apology." Kate cracked a little smile.
"If Utana can forgive you..."
She made an eloquent shrug. "Then you accept?" She nodded.
I do.
"Then please," he said, and knelt before her, "accept me as your student." Kate took a half step back and looked at him as though he were totally mad.
"What?"
"Your technique has inspired me," said Sayanji fervently. "And my own has become hopelessly disordered by all that I've been through, all the bad choices I've made. I must start again, with a master who can rebuild my shattered art into something worthwhile. Having tasted defeat at your hands, I think that master is you."
That's very flattering,
said Kate, a bit uneasily.
But I am only a jern.
She sighed and gestured for Utana, who nodded and took over. "Kate's got a speech impediment that gets really bad when she's talking to strangers and weirdos like you," she told Sayanji. "Anyway, she's flattered, but she's not a master, she's only a journeywoman. She's not qualified to take a student. And while I'm giving you a hassle, could you have been any less subtle about it?" Sayanji replied a little huffily, "I'm not declaring suit, I'm asking for guidance. At any rate, I understand." He rose to his feet and addressed Kate. "When you are, please remember this day. I will be waiting, and in the meantime, I will try to demonstrate my worth." Kate gave him a long, rather dubious look, then said,
"Well, okay, but don't get all freaky on me.
He looked puzzled. "Freaky?"
"Really, Sayanji," said Utana, coming over from her bed to usher him toward the door. "The last thing she needs is you stalking her like some kind of creepy fanboy. Next thing, you'll be cornering her in the gym and foisting an exchange diary on her."
How did you know about that?" he demanded, then shook his head. "Never mind. Another time. Miss Hutchins, I won't harass you," he promised. "I just ask that you remember my wish, and give it consideration when the time is right." Kate nodded.
I'll do that, she assured him. Thanks for coming by.
"Okay, go on," said Utana. "You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here." Sayanji smiled as he allowed himself to be shoved outside. "I'll see you tomorrow, then," he said.